Court of the State of South Dakota, the Honorable David Gilbertson presiding, is now open for the transaction of any business that may legally come before it.
Good morning. The first case for oral argument this morning is Tripp versus Assam and several other parties. For the appellant, we have Mr. James Moore from Sioux Falls, and for the appellees, we have Mr. Timothy Grindy, an attorney from Minneapolis, and Mr. T.J. Von Wald, attorney from Sioux Falls. Mr. Grindy, I understand you'll be doing the arguing this morning. Very well. All right, Mr. Moore, you may proceed, and you have 20 minutes, sir.
Thank you, Your Honor. May it please the Court. I'm James Moore on behalf of Marvin Tripp and Donna Tripp DeShepherd, who are brother and sister. This long-running quiet title action concerns two parcels of property located in the Capitol Hill addition of the city of Sioux Falls. The first is a 33-foot strip of property that, according to an 1888 deed, was 632 feet in length. According to the court's reformation, it was 950 feet in length. The second piece of property is a 100-foot railroad right-of-way that was abandoned by the Illinois Central Railroad in 1984 and sold to Fred Assam. Both pieces of property ultimately depend upon deeds that were signed by Herbert and Eunice Aldrich in 1888. The first is a deed dated January 31, 1888, and that deed concerns title to the 33-foot strip, as argued by Assam and as reformed by the Circuit Court. The second deed is dated March 5, 1888, and is the deed by which the Assams conveyed to the Cherokee and Dakota Railroad the right-of-way property that eventually became Illinois Central's railroad and that was then deeded to Sam Assam in 1984. I'm going to start with the argument related to the 33-foot strip and then deal with the construction of the right-of-way deed. Procedurally, most of what is important in this case happened in Judge Sirska's first decision, in which he construed the right-of-way deed as conveying an easement, as conveying fee title rather than an easement in 1888, and he held that the Aldrich deed dated January 31, 1888 was relevant to Marvin Tripp's claim of title to the 33-foot strip by adverse possession. And although not all of the facts and the logic were clearly explained in Judge Sirska's first decision, it was implicit in his decision that he found that the 1888 deed needed to be reformed, and as reformed, it described the 33-foot strip. Because it described the 33-foot strip, and because that deed contained a limitation in it that the property conveyed was to be used for public purposes, he held that it could not be adversely possessed. I think that there are several problems with the reasoning and the analysis that ultimately led to the court's reformation of the deed dated January 31, 1888. First of all, I don't think that as reformed by the Circuit Court, the deed contained a Scrivener's error. The Circuit Court essentially rewrote the deed, and I don't think that's appropriate. Secondly, the change that was made by the Circuit Court.
Well, wait, just a minute, though. There had to be some error, wasn't there?
Because there clearly was an error.
It's undisputed
that there is an error.
Okay.
I think that you could claim that there was a Scrivener's error in the deed in the use of the term southeasterly as opposed to southwesterly. And by making that one change, that would be a Scrivener's error that the court could properly reform. The Circuit Court went far beyond that and changed the starting point for the meets and bounds description, changed the length of the easement, as well as making that change.
I'm looking at your brief here, and there's an exhibit here. I don't know if you can see it, but
yes.
It shows the orange.
That is the
disputed.
That's the 33-foot strip.
Now, that orange there is what you claim the 33-foot strip is. Is that how the court's reform deed also depicted?
There's no dispute, Your Honor, that shaded orange parcel, which is based on a survey that was done in 1999, is the property that is at issue. I can't tell you whether the deed as reformed by the circuit court corresponds exactly to that 33-foot strip.
You agree that it should, or don't you?
My argument, based on the evidence from Ernest Carlson, who offered an affidavit that was essentially expert testimony in this case, is that if the deed were reformed to change one word, southeasterly to southwesterly, so that the Meats and Browns description goes north, southwesterly, south, and then northeasterly along the northern side of the right-of-way, Mr. Carlson said that would describe a strip of property immediately to the southwest of what is shown in the page that you were just looking at. It would not describe...
What would that be, then? Well, it would not...
It would be the next parcel to the left or to the west.
Does that make logical sense, though? I mean, these were logical people in 1888, and we know what they were assumed trying to do.
I think it makes sense, Your Honor, because as Mr. Carlson explained, there was, in fact, a township road in that location, and it's evidenced on a Cherokee and Dakota Railroad map that is attached, I think, as Exhibit C to Mr. Carlson's affidavit and is in the appendix to my brief, that shows a road in approximately that location. The problem with the court's reformation is, one, I spent a fair amount of time yesterday trying to figure out the exact starting point for the Meets and Bounds description as it was reformed by the circuit court. And I'm not sure that I can place that on the map. You can find the southwest corner if you look at, you have to look at the plat. And if you look at the plat that is attached to the brief and that was initially in evidence, and not the second plat that I've made a motion to supplement the record with, because the two are different. But if you look at the first map, of the Capitol Hill addition to the city of Sioux Falls, this is the southeast quarter of Section 13. And this would be the starting point. And so you go either 600, the deed originally said you go 632 feet to the west of that starting point, and then you go north. And from there, you go north, and then it said you go southeasterly as opposed to southwesterly, and then you go north, and then you go for south, and then you go northeasterly. That's obviously not correct. It doesn't work. But the problem is orienting that starting point. And if you figure out, based on the feet that are identified with each of these blocks, including the 66 feet for the streets that are in between them, if you try to orient yourself to either the 632 feet that was originally stated in the deed, or the 950 feet west of this starting point, which is the corner of the section, I think you'll have a hard time placing the deeded parcel in the area of the 33-foot strip. It certainly doesn't work exactly, and it may even take a little bit of basic geometry to figure out how some of the distances that are involved. But there's no evidence in the record.
And was that information given to the trial court that this doesn't make sense?
Your Honor, the issue of reformation was presented to the trial court initially, but never, because of the way this case developed procedurally, was never really explicitly argued to Judge Sirtska, and it wasn't analyzed by Judge Sirtska. And I think the problem is that there's no evidence in the record that would explain how the deed was wrong in so many particulars. How do we get from 632 feet west of that starting point to 950 feet? How do we change the direction north from 83 feet to 126 feet?
Well, I think we took under advisement whether we would let you add this additional plat here.
Yes.
We've got it here now. We haven't decided whether we're going to use it or not, but if we do, how does it help us?
Well, I think what it establishes is that there is certainly not clear and convincing evidence, Your Honor, about what the parties intended with respect to the January 31, 1888 deed in 1888. What the plat shows, what the two plats show, is if you will look at the drawing on the plat that's attached to the motion, it shows a straight line running across what I refer to as the bottom portions, the southerly portions of blocks 62, 63, 64, which is the north side of the abandoned railroad right-of-way. In contrast, the other plat that is in the record shows a jog in the line between block 63 and block 62. The interesting thing, if you look at the distances and the measurements that are contained on those two plats, is that the distances don't make sense. The looking at the west side of block 63, the measurement there is 176.8 feet. If you look at the east side of block 62, the measurement there is 153 feet, and it is shown to be longer than the measurement that is 176 feet. It's obviously not a correct drawing. And the question is whether the drawing is correct or whether the measurement is correct. It also shows a distance of 83 feet in connection with the abandoned right-of-way, which wasn't abandoned at the time, immediately to the south of block 62, which would reflect the distance of 50 feet associated with the right-of-way and an additional 33 feet associated with some additional roadway. The problem is that these two things are inconsistent, and I would suggest to you that neither one of them can be correctly drawn if you look at the distances. And so the question is, how can we establish from this, and this is the evidence that ASIM points to support the circuit court's reformation, how can we say that this is clear, unequivocal, and convincing evidence, which is what is required for a deed to be reformed, that what the parties intended at the time of the 1888 deed was to convey property that somehow today exactly correlates to the 33-foot strip.
The concern I have about that is the second plat tends to show that maybe the first plat is not consistent. Is that the point of the plat that you're asking us to take judicial notice of?
The only point I want to make, Your Honor, is that I don't think you can determine anything from the two plats because neither one of them makes sense to me.
Right, but the second plat confirms that maybe the first plat's susceptible to doubt.
I think it does. The second plat is itself susceptible to doubt.
Okay, but my point then is it fair to look at that second plat because Judge Sirska didn't. I don't think Judge Sirska saw it. I'm not sure. I need to know from you, I guess.
He didn't see it, Your Honor, because it wasn't part of the record.
So what I'm concerned about is that if you're using the second plat to sort of impeach or to add credibility to your argument, to impeach the first plat and add credibility to your argument, that these don't really prove what the other side wants. Is that, I don't know that that's fair to Judge Sirska because he didn't have that evidence.
To some extent, I agree with you, Your Honor, but the fact is that the plat is of record with the Register of Deeds in Minnehaha County, and with respect to the merits of the case and determination of whether the 1888 deed was properly reformed, sufficient that it deprives my client of his claim to title to the 33-foot strip by adverse possession, I think it's fair that the court consider it. I think that you can determine that Judge Sirska's reformation of the deed was improper without consideration of the second plat, because I don't think you can take the first plat and orient the deed as reformed by the circuit court on that plat and say, oh, yes, we can tell that this exactly describes the 33-foot strip. I don't think you can do that. And so maybe it's unnecessary for you to reach the second plat, and maybe it's unnecessary for you to grant that motion. But I wanted the court to be aware of it because when I realized that the emphasis that Mr. Assam was placing on the plat as really the only evidence in the record supporting what the circuit court did, I remembered that, in fact, I had seen a different plat and went back to the Register of Deeds and got a copy of it and offered it through the motion so that it's now before this court. The other problem with the reformation that Judge Sirska did, I think, is the statute of limitations. And it's a fairly straightforward argument. The deed was 1888. We know from the Tripkin case that there is a 10-year statute of limitation that applies to reformation of the deed. The question is, when did the statute begin to run? My argument was to the circuit court that it began to run based on constructive notice, and that was in 1984 when Fred Assam acquired the abandoned right-of-way from the Illinois Central Railroad.
If we agree with you on that, on the 10-year statute of limitations, what then do we have to decide? Anything?
Well, I think, Your Honor, what's left is that the deed could not be reformed, in which case it does not describe a bounded parcel, and it clearly does not describe the 33-foot strip, in which case it's undisputed in the record that the only claim to the 33-foot strip is Marvin Tripp's claim by adverse possession. Sam Assam, as the owner of the railroad right-of-way property, has not made any claim that he in any way used the 33-foot strip, most of which is enclosed by a barbed wire fence.
So then we don't have to decide whether it's a fee simple or just a right-of-way.
We still have to get to that question, Your Honor, because that concerns title to the railroad right-of-way. But actually, you could decide the first question related to the January 31, 1888 deed, simply on the basis of the statute of limitation, and say we don't need to reach the other questions about reformation and the Scrivener's error and how we should actually do this in the second plat. We can just say that the statute of limitation ran because the deed that was recorded provided constructive notice to Sam Assam or to Fred Assam in 1984, and that's the end of that issue.
Mr. Moore, we all know that constructive notice is provided in a deed, but is it fair to say that constructive notice can be established on the very technical nature of a complicated meets and bounds description that doesn't close? I mean, a lawyer couldn't look at that and tell you whether or not it closed. You've got to have a title person or a geometry person or somebody in the sciences to tell you whether that thing closes.
I don't think that's true, Your Honor. All you need to know is that all you need to know is that if you go those four directions, it doesn't create a square or a parallelogram.
But with the feet, I mean, unless it's a rectangle, I think I'm confident to do a rectangle. But beyond rectangles, it gets a little hairy.
But that's all you need to know that it doesn't close. You don't have to know the correct number of feet. You don't have to know the starting point. You just have to look at the directions and see that they don't, and see that they go this way as opposed to going this way. And I think, Your Honor, I'm not aware of any case law that would establish that constructive notice of the contents of a deed is limited to certain aspects of the deed. I mean, I think if you have constructive notice of the deed, you have, the cases say you have constructive notice of everything that is contained in that deed, and if there's a small error in that deed, you have notice of that. That's the whole point of constructive notice. I do want to reach the second issue related to construction of the right-of-way deed before my initial time is up. I think that this court's cases addressing construction of similar deeds leave somewhat in doubt the proper construction of this particular deed. This particular deed is called a right-of-way deed. It uses the terms grant and convey. It says that the purpose of the deed is to convey property to be used in connection with the construction, maintenance, and operation of a railroad, and it also contains warranty language. Because it has both elements of a right-of-way deed and because it contains warranty language, I don't think it fits neatly within either the Meyrink decision or the Northwest Realty versus Jacobs case. And I think those are the two principal cases, and I think to some extent they're in conflict. Especially they're in conflict to the extent that the Northwest Realty decision mentions the public policy against private ownership of narrow strips of land. And there's a good reason for that public policy argument, and it's because I think this case is the perfect illustration of it. This case has been going on for 7 years. It started out as a dispute over a 33-foot strip of property. We're still litigating, and one of the reasons is because Fred Assam was able to buy an abandoned right-of-way 100 feet long that runs all the way through Section 13 and across the south side of Block 62 and Block 64, which are part of the Tripp's property. If the public policy were different, such that the Illinois Central Railroad's predecessor had obtained only an easement from the Aldriches in 1888, upon their abandonment of the railroad, that property would have either reverted to adjoining landowners or it would have reverted to the heirs of the Aldriches, who were sued, by the way, in this quiet title action, served by publication, and who made no appearance. So any judgment would be binding as to them. The result of that...
Your time has expired, Mr. Moore. Thank you.
Thank you.
Okay. Mr. Grandy, you have 20 minutes.
Thank you, Your Honor.
Thank you. Timothy Grand appearing on behalf of the respondents along with T.J. Van Wold. Just to make sure we're all on the same page, because I sense there might be a little bit of an issue. You have the long railroad right-of-way, 100 feet wide. That's the deed or easement issue on that one. So you've got the long right-of-way, that's the deed or easement issue. And next to the right-of-way, there's the 33-foot strip, which has the public road language in it. So when we're talking about the 33-foot strip, it's not the long right-of-way we're talking about. So the whole Mayor Link Sherman case issue deals with the right-of-way, and most of appellant's argument dealt with the 33-foot strip, which is next to the right-of-way. Just to make that clear.
How do we know from looking at the... Right, get to the guts of this. How do we know from looking at the court's reform deed where that is exactly?
Well, the legal description, it starts at the southwest corner, and it describes the 33-foot parcel going back up the right-of-way till it hits just south of Joliet Avenue. And I think it's instructive. The two maps that we have from 1888... First of all, you have the grantors, who were the Aldriches, and then you have the grantees, who were the railroad. Now, we think the grantors expressed their intent as to where that 33-foot parcel was in the plat. That's the capital edition plat that you have in front of us, you at the defendant's appellate's appendix number 44, which shows a carve-out of the road in blocks 61 and 62, where the Assam defendants believe it is. So, in other words, we feel the Aldriches expressed their intent as a grantor is where that was. And then the railroad also has a contemporaneous map, which you've already pointed to. It's at defendant appellants, appendix number 103, which also shows where the railroad at the same time thought the road was. And that's where the Assam defendants think the road is also. And it's when you try to place where actually that road is on this map, which I've also done, I think the place where you can actually figure out where these people think it is and how it fits into the current map is this. If you follow the southerly line of the right-of-way to where the southerly line of the right-of-way actually touches the section line, That's where I think you can bring all of the pictures we have together. The southerly line of that right-of-way touches the section line just south of the extension of Joliet Avenue on the current plats. And the roadway on the railroad map, if you go up, you can see also starts just to the left of where that right-of-way line hits the section line. So I think that's the common denominator in all of the documents we have together. Because
but
if you
the
look
reform
at
deed, when you look at the reform deed and you look at how the court has described this property, it's difficult to tell where it begins and ends. It's difficult to know I mean, I hear you, see you explaining it to us and pointing it out, but the Reform D doesn't necessarily correspond to what you're pointing to.
I think the legal, well, I guess I disagree. We had a surveyor, one of the reasons they reformed the deed is to make sure it describes exactly what it was that was intended by the parties, and you don't necessarily have to start at the same point. And we think there was a transposition error made by the person who drafted the legal description between the starting points, the 632-foot figure and the 950 figure. If you transpose those, you come to a starting point down on the other side of the road, and that's why it looks so differently, is it just uses a different starting point, which seems to make more sense to the surveyor that we have. And it describes that 33-foot parcel starting just south of Joliet Avenue and then extending southwest. So I think Judge Shifka and Caldwell did find that the legal description described what was in the pictures and what was intended by the grantor and the...
So this orange here, you're contending that this orange... You can see it from there.
Yes, yes.
Does, in fact, correspond to what the judge's reform deeds say?
Sure, and in fact, it goes a little bit further to the southwest, because obviously when we're reforming a deed, we're trying to, and that doesn't necessarily affect Tripp's, because Tripp doesn't own the land. That's, you know, so that wouldn't be part of his adverse possession claims. He's not adjacent to it. But if we're reforming a deed to match the original intent, we're going to take care of our title problem right now and make sure that it actually, correct the scriveners there so that it matches, you know, for our property going forward, so that we solve the title problem once and for all. We're in a quiet title action. That's why we did it in the first point. So, and I think, you know, the emphasis that Tripp's put on trying to correct the legal description by amending as few words as possible. Yes, it is possible to make this thing close by changing only one word, but the end result of that was not necessarily to try to put the land where the Aldriches and the railroad intended to put it. It's just to see where that thing ends up when you change that one word.
How do we know that?
Well, we don't know, and I guess it was our point to the circuit court that the best evidence of the intent of the time is the only two pictures we have, is the railroad map and the plat map. That, we think, shows the intent, and if the legal description matches the intent, that would be the proper way to reform the deed.
And I take it they both support your position.
Yes.
Okay.
Yes. In fact, if you look at the motion. That was made to include the second plat. If you look real carefully at it, that actually supports our position too, because remember, if you follow the railroad map and the plat that's in the record, the road starts right at Joliet Avenue and goes southwest, right along the right-of-way. If you look at the plat map submitted by Tripp's in the motion, it doesn't have the same little carve-out up on blocks 61 and 62, but you'll see right to the west of Joliet Avenue, it's got a little 50 by it, which shows the distance between the center center line of the railroad to the end of the right-of-way. And then right on the other side of Joliet Avenue, there's an 83 in there, if you check that map out closely. So what that map says is that right on the west side of Joliet Avenue, it's 50 feet from the center line to the outside of the right-of-way, and then on the other side of Joliet Avenue, it's 83 feet. And that shows. Do I object real hard if that comes in? It kind of supports our position because it shows that right at Joliet Avenue, that distance that was carved out of the plat goes from 50 feet to 82 feet, which is, the math is, 33 feet. That's the road. It just doesn't show it as a cutout of those blocks. But the distance written in by the surveyor shows the 50, going from 50 feet to 83 feet.
Well, if it kind of supports your position, do you have any objection to it coming in?
I guess I would not. I don't think it shows a discrepancy. But would I waive that objection? I don't think I'd be willing to waive the objection, because the point I wanted to make in my argument was that, well, Judge Sierska didn't have it. You know, presumably that's where the ruling was made. And I don't think it shows, if you were to send it down to say that creates an issue of fact because they differ, I don't think they differ, but I suppose, I don't think I'd be willing to waive that objection yet. Judge Sierska didn't have the problem, so.
All right.
So that's all. That's about it. So I think it's important that the pictures actually do match up, and that's evidence of the grantor's intent and the grantee's intent. We're lucky in that sense that we got both sides of the transaction who actually drew a picture of it and left it a record, and that's how we think Judge Sierska found that matter. Once the judge, we believe, determine that is the piece of land. That's actually what we're trying to find out, is the piece of land that the parties actually intended. Then I think it's an easy, pretty easy thing to match the language to. That's just a surveyor's type of exercise after that to make sure the legal description actually describes the property which the parties, the Aldriches and the railroad, intended to transfer. And Assam parties are comfortable that the legal description, and so is Judge Sierska, actually describes that land. And if we were to rely on the opinion of the surveyor that the Tripps have hired, you would be conveying an entirely different strip of land to the southwest, which, I think, if you follow that through, actually moves into a different section, as Mr. Moore noted. So, I mean, was it the intent that this actually move into a different section? There's nothing in the legal description which talks about a different section. It only talks about this section. So, I think they tried to force the closure with one word, and then tried to see where that road, where that road actually would end up, and it ends up in a place which isn't supported by the two pictures we have, and puts it in an area which makes no sense. I want to spend a little bit of time, then we get to the adverse possession issue, and the point's well taken. If the Judge Sierska said on that 33-foot parcel, not the right-of-way, he said, yeah, there's language in there that talks about it being conveyed for a public road. Because it's a public road, you can't have adverse possession. Tripp's point being, well, if the 33-foot parcel we're talking about is actually down here, well, then I can get adverse possession to that because Sierska's ruling wouldn't control, because he's talking about a different piece of land. And I just wanted to point out that the evidence of adverse possession, which was introduced at the summary judgment stage, was not one way. It was hotly contested. Both sides cited testimony before Judge Sierska supporting their position, and it would be the Assam's position that nothing happened on that land significant from the time that Lyle Tripp, Mr. Tripp's father, tore down his house in 1975. He tore down the house that was where he actually lived on that property in 1975 or 77, and never occupied the premises thereafter. There's virtually no evidence that anything happened after 77. There was no maintenance of the road, and there was a little bit of mowing on the inside of the fence and some spraying of some weeds, but that's not a lot of activity on a piece of property for 33 years, or however long it was before the lawsuit started. So I guess the point being that if adverse possession ever became an issue, that has to go back down to the trial court. That was disputed, I believe.
What about the 10 years?
10 years. We're dealing there. We seem to agree that the statute of limitations is 10 years. That's the two cases we have ending up with the Trip 10 case. The issue really is when does it commence? So the constructive notice argument offered by the Trips was, well, it starts as soon as you have record notice that, or constructive notice that the document was actually there. So in other words, Tripp would argue that the statute of limitations would actually start in, I guess, 1888 when the deed was filed. And if you read the, well, to look at the Tripp 10 case, the Tripp 10 case actually adopted the earlier decision of the court saying that, yes, 10 years is the appropriate statute for reformation of deed. But that starts when you discover when you discover the defect. And in the trip,
why not the 10 years when it was originally purchased from the railroad? The constructive notice there.
Because I think that, again, the constructive notice issue in the cases that TRIP cite refer to a constructive notice of the document itself. And if you look at the statute about constructive notice, it talks about you having constructive notice that the document is of record and was executed. And if you read the Fullerton case cited by TRIPS, that's the point he was trying to make. In fact, the Fullerton case was an interesting case because it was the case in South Dakota which said that a buyer has record of a filed document outside of his chain of title. That's what the interesting part of that case I thought was. But I don't think the issue we have in front of us is that the parties didn't know of the documents that were out there which contained the error. In any reformation case you have of a contract, both parties recognize the document is there. They both signed it. The problem was they don't know that there was an error in it. And so I think on a reformation it makes sense that you go from the time that the defect is actually identified. And I think the only place you get by the constructive notice argument is that the parties have constructive notice that the document exists. And in a reformation action, I just don't think that makes sense because both parties obviously know that the document exists when they signed it. And I don't think it makes sense in a reformation action to start it then either, especially when it comes to deeds, because oftentimes you're not going to find these errors in deeds till long after these deeds. You know, some of these deeds have been of record 100, 120 years. If you adopt a rule which starts it as of the constructive notice of the filing of the document, then the buried error starts running there. I mean, it starts running as of the date it was filed, and if you haven't caught it in that first 10 years, even people who are subsequent purchasers, they're out of luck. So, and I just don't think that's wise. I think the reformation of deed policy is better left in place with discovery of the defect. And that's in effect what TRIP 10 found. TRIP 10 found, and that was the court construing a contract for deed. The TRIP case, there's specific language in the TRIP 10 case which states that it starts at the, and in the TRIP 10 case, if you remember, the contract for deed had a provision in it where it was a complicated amortization schedule, much like a complicated legal description. An accountant later on discovered that there was an error in the amortization schedule of the deed, the contract for deed. So it was a deed action. And he found out that error much after 10 years after it was filed. And the court said, no, the starting date for that is the date the accountant discovered the error in the amortization schedule. So we think there's pretty clear case law for starting that statute of limitations period, or a pretty clear case law in TRIP 10 that it starts from the discovery of the defect, not the filing of the document. Otherwise, TRIP 10 would have been held the other way. So I think that's the issue there. I have a little time left, and I guess I can move on to the, in many ways, it's a much more important issue for the asking defendants is the 100-foot right-of-way which was purchased. The Assams purchased the 100-foot right-of-way and the 33-foot strip and paid value to the railroad for these. The people, I mean, if you look at the one case, the Jordan case, I think it was, it has the 7-factor test for determining whether or not, whatever it is. Well, one of the factors was, how did the parties treat this property over the years? Well, the property treated this property over the years by the railroad selling it in fee to the Assams, who actually paid for it, and by the way, it paid taxes on this parcel for the requisite 10-year period. So in other words, we think there's also a separate basis, which Judge Searska didn't find, that by paying taxes on this land, you own it, and I think that's...
Was that raised to Judge Searska?
Yeah, but he didn't need to get there. Because the judge looked at the deed, found it unambiguous, and said, you know, there's a title on the top of the deed for right-of-way, and in Judge Searska's mind, everything else in the deed indicated a fee. And if you look at the Maryland decision and the Sherman decision particularly, we think that case law supported Judge Searska's ruling. The Maryland case was interesting. What you have in Maryland was you have a railroad right-of-way deed in the name. Not in the conveyancing language. And that separates out some of the highway cases. But the name was right-of-way, And the only thing else that we know about Maralink is that it had the warrants and conveys language in it. So that's what Maralink is. And Maralink, they said right away, not in the conveyancing language, the intent's in the deed for a deed. So right of way, which we normally could construe as an easement, doesn't count here because of the conveyancing intent in the deed. That's what Maralink is. And then you come to the Sherman case, where the Sherman case didn't have right of way in the name. But the Sherman case was important because in the Sherman case, they had the railroad language. You know, they said, for use as a railroad. And, you know, so is that a limitation which we can turn this into an easement? Well, that's when the Sherman court focused on the original 1877 or 1888 Railroad Act, which says railroads can either buy or use the condemnation authority of the state to take the property. And then, as the Sherman Court noted, that means to operate as a railroad, to do X, Y, and Z, support other buildings, and to, when they're done with it, if they don't need it as a railroad anymore, to sell it. So that's where the Sherman Court came down and says, you know, the language in the deed which talks about for railroad purposes, that just mirrors the language in the Act, which says this is the purpose that the railroad can take it for. And one of those purposes by the Act itself was to, when you're done with it, you can sell the fee. So I think that's what separates out railroad cases, by the way. So I'm just about out of time. So there's one more point I wanted to make about the easement cases, but can't recall what that was. So thank you very much.
Thank you, Mr. Grant. Mr. Moore, you have 10 minutes, sir.
Thank you, Your Honor. Justice Koenigsegg, you asked Mr. Grant to explain how you can tell from the record, looking at page 17 of our appendix, where this is. And, Your Honor, I don't think you can. I think to affirm Judge Sirska's decision, you would need to be able to explain in a published decision, here's the southeast corner of the southwest quarter of Section 13. That's what this block is part of. Here's the southeast corner. You have to be able to explain that this corner right here, the lower right-hand corner of the shaded orange area, is 632 feet west of that point and 120 feet north. And I challenge you to find evidence in the record that will allow you to do that.
What
I don't think there is any.
What about the transposition letter with the 6 and the 9? Does it work out if you do transpose?
It's not just a transposition of a 6 and a 9. This distance was 950 feet west of the southeast corner of the section, is what the deed said. 950 feet west, that changed to 632 feet. It originally said 83 feet north, that changed to 126 feet. Why? How? What evidence supports that? Mr. Grant says, well, our surveyor said it did. There's nothing in the record from his surveyor. I don't know who his surveyor is. There's no affidavit from a surveyor. There's no survey from a surveyor. There's no testimony from a surveyor. There is nothing in the record that would allow you to equate the deed as reformed by the circuit court with that orange-shaded parcel. Nothing. And that's the reason that it's wrong. It's not supported by the evidence. And according to the standard, it has to be clear, unequivocal, and convincing evidence. And there isn't evidence in the record of that at all. With respect to the second plat, I just want to make sure that I'm understood on the problem with both of these plats. If you look at, in the second plat, if you look at the left side of block 63, the measurement is 176.8. If you look at the right side of block 62, the measurement is 153. Can't be the way that it's drawn, because the right side of block 62 is actually longer in that dimension than the left side of block 63. If you look at the plat that is in the record, it shows a dimension for the left side of block 63 as 176 feet. If you look at the left side of block 62, it shows a dimension of 190 feet. And the problem is, the way that these are drawn, they are exactly the same length and yet are shown different dimensions. Neither of these plats is convincing evidence, clear, convincing, and unequivocal evidence of what Herbert and Eunice Aldrich intended when they conveyed property to the Cherokee and Dakota Railroad on January 31, 1888. And that's all that's in the record. My argument is, given the paucity of any evidence in the record that would establish a basis to reform the deed, it can't be reformed. If it can't be reformed, it does not describe the orange-shaded area, which is the property to which Marvin Tripp claims title by adverse possession. And I can't help but note that when Mr. Grand stands here and says that there are questions in the fact about, in the questions of fact in the record about adverse possession, if you agree that this property is not described by the January 31, 1888 deed, ASSAM has absolutely no stake in Marvin Tripp's claim to this property by adverse possession. None whatsoever. Does not even have standing to challenge the facts that Marvin Tripp has presented that he has title to that property by adverse possession.
So you said if it can't be reformed, and that, are there cases where that is actually what the court just says? That it can't be reformed?
Well, clearly if the statute of limitation applied, it couldn't be reformed. And I think, Your Honor, the recognition that that a deed that's over 100 years old contains an error in it doesn't mean that it has to be fixed at this point. Well, because that's the situation we're in.
So there's, it'd be almost void then, really. Then.
For all practical purposes today, and it's not going to have any consequence. Because there's no dispute about title to the property to the southwest of where that strip is. And I want to clarify one other point that Mr. Grand made. He said that where we claim, based on Mr. Carlson's affidavit in the record, that parcel would be if you reform the deed by changing one direction. He says it's in a different section. That's not true. The Capitol Hill addition is the southwest quarter of Section 13, Township 101, Range 59 West, I think. Maybe it's 49. Block 62 is right here, part of Marvin Tripp's property. All we're claiming is that the deeded area, if the deed were reformed, as Mr. Carlson says it should be, would be south of Block 61 and south of Block 60. The section goes over here, and you can see on the map where the southwest corner of the section is. Here's the southeast corner. Here's the southwest corner. We're not out of the section. We're not even outside of what is shown as roadway on this plat. The most logical reformation of the deed, based on the evidence in the record, is the one that Mr. Carlson proposed. It's certainly not the one that the circuit court adopted, because there isn't any evidence in the record to establish that. With respect to the issue about the statute being 10 years and when does it begin to run, Mr. Grand suggested that based on my argument, it begins to run in 1888. That's not true. I'm arguing that it begins to run in 1984, which is the date that Mr. ASSAM purchased the abandoned railroad right-of-way from the Illinois Central Railroad. And with respect to your question, Justice Zinner, about what notice you actually are charged with if you have constructive notice of the deed, I would refer the court to the Lunstra decision, which is reported at 442 Northwest 2nd, 448, and this is cited in my brief at page 21, and citing SDCL 43-28-15, this court said, the recordation of an instrument serves as constructive notice of what the instrument actually contains. It's not just notice of the instrument, it's notice of what the instrument actually contains.
Did Judge Sirska have the benefit of Ernest Carlson's plan of reformation?
Yes.
Did he give any reasons why he rejected it?
No.
As you say, he just didn't analyze that issue, or what?
He didn't analyze reformation at all. There's no mention in that initial decision of reformation. But implicitly, the only way that his decision makes any sense is if he determined that the deed had to be reformed. The issue was in front of him in the acknowledgement that the deed had to be reformed in his second decision, which addressed the statute of limitation. But there is no explicit analysis in any decision from Judge Sirska of whether the initial deed should be reformed and how. And so there's no discussion of Ernest Carlson's affidavit. With respect to the construction of the right-of-way deed, again, I think that there are really four principal decisions, as discussed in our brief, that bear on that issue. I think they're hard to reconcile, in part because not each of those decisions contains an in-depth discussion of all of the varying factors that you find in the cases about construing railroad right-of-way deeds. The one decision may mention this language and says, well, it says right-of-way, and that's dispositive. There's no discussion about whether the deed might also have contained a limitation to right-of-way purposes or warranty language. The Myrick decision says, well, there's warranty language in this case, and that's dispositive. There's no discussion in that case about whether the deed also contained a restriction that the property was to be used only for railroad purposes. And so I think it's unclear, based on this court's decisions, how that deed should be construed. I think it would be helpful, because this issue comes up actually quite frequently in practice, given railroad right-of-ways around the state, how those deeds need to be construed, and given the majority of cases that are consistent with this court's expression in the Northwest Realty decision, that public policy does bear a role in that decision, and that it makes sense that we not have private ownership of narrow strips of land that are abutting other more significant parcels of property, that it would be helpful for this court to resolve the ambiguity that exists in the previous decisions and to hold that this deed conveyed only an easement and not fee in 1888. Thank you.
Thank you, Mr. Moore. Court will be in recess for 10 minutes.